Good morning. Welcome to House Education Finance Committee. I'll call us to order. We have a quorum now, so we can do minutes. Let's see. Representative Jordan, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair. I've examined the minutes from March 21st, 2023, and I move their approval.
Thank you. Representative Jordan moves the March 21st minutes. Any questions on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. The minutes for March 21st are adopted. With that, we have a full agenda, so we'll move right into it. We have Representative Purcell and House File 2042. Well, Representative Purcell, welcome to your committee. Would you like to move your bill before the committee with the intention of laying it over for possible inclusion in the education finance bill?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. That's the motion, and go ahead and proceed.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. We have before us Bill 2042. I'm not sure, Madam Chair, if you would also like us to move the author's amendment that goes
yes,
on.
Madam Chair. Yes, we would. Madam Chair.
Promoted.
You can have it for this week. Representative Purcell, would you like to move the A1 amendment before us? Would you like to briefly explain the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Very simply, it adds labor into the list of potential partners for CTE.
Wonderful. Thank you. Members, we have the A1 amendment before us. Is there any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. The A1 amendment's adopted. With that, Representative Purcell, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 2042 as amended is to codify language around a series of career and technical education consortia pilot projects. Beginning in 2016, these CTE consortia grants were focused on rural regions, first in the southwest area of the state, then southeast, northern regions, and so forth through the rest of greater Minnesota. The pilot grants are included in the ongoing base budget, but there's no language providing structure and direction for future of these funds. In speaking with the advocates for these pilot projects, they would like to codify the work that's being done and ensure that dollars are available statewide to a variety of eligible consortia partners while utilizing the service cooperative statewide administrative reach. The bill would increase the current $3 million a year in the base to $5 million a year, recognizing the increased footprint of the CTE consortia. We've talked a lot about the importance of CTE programs and partnerships this session, and this is a bill that can really bring those conversations to life. I'm going to yield my time so that my testifiers may speak, and you'll also note several letters of support for this bill in your packets. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. With that, we have Alicia Bredesen, and then Jaden Bredesen, Jeremy Kovash, and Darren Kermes. So, Alicia, would you like to state your name for the record, and please proceed.
Alicia Bredesen. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee. When I think about how the CNA program changed my life, I am reminded how many other people's lives were changed also. In 2020, my granddaughter tried to commit suicide. She was lost. After several months of therapy, things started to look up. When my granddaughter was approved a spot in the CNA program, she was entering her senior year of high school, working a part-time job, and now the CNA program, still with COVID nipping at our heels, creating money barriers for this program. She graduated and finished the CNA program. She had changed unbelievably. She got a job at the local nursing home. This program saved her life and has made such an impact on all of those she loves and cares for. She's a beautiful young woman now living on her own, happy and looking forward to the future. Although you may never know the impact that this program has made in people's lives, I'm here to tell you it has and it will continue to. Thank you for helping my granddaughter find her future. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your personal story. Next up, we have Jaden Bredesen. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good
Good morning. My name is Jaden Cease. Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today. I would like to take this opportunity to thank you for funding programs like the CNA program and tell you about my journey. My name is Jaden Cease. I'm a 2022 graduate of Stuartville Public Schools, where I had the chance to be a part of a CNA program. At this time, I was really struggling to find a sense of direction. Schools were just going back to in-person learning, and I was working part-time at the local Taco Bell, making equal wages. When I took the program, I felt dedicated and intelligent. I felt that I was beginning to find a purpose. I've been working now as a CNA for 10 months. Within these months, I've grown to be more patient and empathetic towards others. Being with residents at such a vulnerable time in their lives makes me a more considerate person, and I value that. Being a CNA has given me a sense of purpose and helped me grow as an individual. And once again, I'd just like to thank you for funding that program so that I got this opportunity.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the work that you do with those that need it the most.
Of course.
Next up, we have Jeremy Kovash and then Darren Kermes. Go ahead, state your name for the record and proceed.
Jeremy Kovash. Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. I am the Executive Director of Lakes Country Service Cooperative, and I'm here today to contribute support for our House File 2042 by sharing testimony of our current programs and using funding to enhance career and technical education. Today, we have students from Cass Lake partnering with Johnson Lumber to use CNC equipment and CAD software and prepare them for the workforce. Today, we have students completing automotive internships from Hibbing's automotive class. Today, we have teacher externships at locations such as Millerburn Manufacturing in Winsted, partnering with labor and industry. Today, in our region, 32 school districts were awarded ShopSaber CNC routers and will receive valuable professional development over the next months to provide innovative, career-ready training for their students. Today, we have special education and traditional students partnering to run a school coffee shop in Mankato, which provides authentic work-based learning and removes transportation barriers. Today, students from Murray County Central and Fulda are teaming with Murray County Medical Center to earn college credits and essential skills for healthcare careers. Today, these legislatively appropriated funds have provided support for 94 teachers to be licensed appropriately across Minnesota. Additionally, we currently have many more teachers enrolled to add key components to their licensure areas, providing more opportunities for students and in turn our business, manufacturing, and industry partners. Specifically, we have 23 candidates enrolled in construction, 16 enrolled in manufacturing, 5 in transportation, and over 50 candidates enrolled in work-based learning. And finally today, over 100 career and tech ed teachers have been provided mentorship and induction through our ongoing CTE teacher induction program. In closing, the Minnesota Service Cooperatives look forward to continuing and growing partnerships with labor, industry, and manufacturing in our great state. We are proud of the progress we have made to date and look forward to continuing to shape the landscape for career and technical education. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for sharing all that you're doing to make sure that all of our students have multiple options. So thank you. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Darren Kermes. I am the Superintendent of Southwest Metro Intermediate School District. My area covers from New Richland, Heartland, Ellendale, Geneva, and Waseca up to Buffalo, Hanover, Montrose, and St. Michael, Albertville, and including all of the schools in Carver and Scott County. One of the main areas that we provide services in addition to special education is career and technical education, and one of the beauties of this bill is it would bring the Metro in to the existing grants that are available. I note specific language in the bill, especially in Subdivision 2, number 2, developing programs that focus on industry sectors. And I just want to highlight a little bit of what we have done in recent years. Again, I mentioned Scott County. Well, we have Mystic Lake. We have Canterbury. We have the Renaissance Festival. We have other areas there where there is a strong call for hospitality. culinary professions, others. So this year we created a program. We were able to lure the executive chef from Surly down to come and work his magic with kids. And it fulfills a need that we heard a call in our communities. This year, another area, I happened to be sitting in a meeting with a couple of real estate agents who were talking about presenting homes and the value of having drone footage in marketing real estate and the difficulty of getting people qualified to fly a drone, take pictures. We created a drone program, and our kids absolutely love it. In fact, I sit in once in a while to figure out how to fly my drone around. Those are just a couple of examples of what we're already doing, but I would submit to you that in our high schools, if we want to add a calculus course or an AP course or something else, we need a teacher, we need a classroom, and we need some curriculum. It's a little more than that, but that's basically what you need to start up a class. But if we want to start an automotive program, or if we want to start a culinary program, like I just noted, the startup costs are considerable. The grants available here would help us, with, especially with some of those one-time funds, to build a program. I'd also like to shift gears for just a minute and tell you just a quick story, because one of the other areas that I think is particularly powerful here is in Subdivision 2, Number 5, where it talks about family and student awareness. So I'm in a blended family. Between us and extended families, we have more degrees than we really want to talk about. And our kids have, you know, it wasn't a question of which college or aren't you going to college, it's which college are you going to. And yet my stepson, he humored us. You know, he took the tests. He's a very smart kid. He got into the U of M, Wisconsin-Madison, among others. He said, well, let me go to Normandale. We said, fine, you can get your generals done. He humored us by going there. He flunked out. He hated it. He really wanted to be a chef. So he was one of the last people that went through Le Cordon Bleu. Now, granted, not one of our programs, but yet in that area, it was his parents, myself included. It was one of the things I'm most regretful of. Because I'm going, no, you got to go to college. You need to go. That's where we all went. You need to do that. And he said, but I want to cook. I want to create. I want to be a chef. If I'm running programs, and it was my own staff who came back to me and kind of guilt-shamed me about, you're not promoting us, you know, what are you doing? You know, your own stepson wants to go and you won't support this. I had to rethink that. If that's my family background, and again, think of Carver and Scott counties, where that is a very much a go to a four-year, I am not in any way speaking against four-year colleges, but I do think to help families, to give them legitimate information about other options, including the trades or about career and technical opportunities that are there, is critically important. And that's one of the primary things we would look to do, is take down some of those barriers to at least considering some of these options. So, again, I appreciate your time. Thank you for hearing this bill. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. And we would love to see this supported and so we can do great things for kids.
Thank you so much. And you're right, we need to change that frame that we're how we're talking to our students and our future workforce. With that, members, we didn't have anybody for the public to sign up to testify. Are there any questions or comments at the table? Seeing none, I will make some questions and comments because I think this is an awesome program. No, really, honestly, having students have those different pathways past college, not everybody wants to do a four-year brick and mortar, and having us change that frame. When I started working in the schools 8 years ago and during the interim, that was one of the frames I had to change in my mind when I'd work in study halls, lunchroom, in the hallways with the kiddos, somebody who might not want to be in school, and taking that lap with them to see what's up, and also making sure to say, so what are your plans after high school, versus where are you going to college? So I think we all have a lot of work to do in that area, and I just want to thank you guys for diving in and doing this work and being willing to expand it all over the state. So with that, Representative Purcell, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank my testifiers. These two gentlemen were wonderful. Our first two testifiers, thank you for sharing your vulnerability and your very personal story. And Jaden, I'm glad you're still here. I hope to have your support Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. With that, 2042 is laid over as amended for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill. Members, we're going to switch up the agenda real quick, and we're going to call up Representative Frazier. Representative Frazier, welcome back to the committee. And Representative Representative Green, would you like to move House File 2068 before the committee for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill?
So moved.
2214 before the committee. Thank you. With that, Representative Reed moves that over, and now Representative Frazier, would you like to present your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. Thank you for accommodating me with the timing of moving me up, and thank you for the opportunity to present this bill. Today, I'm here to present House File 2214, which is an appropriation bill for Black Men Teach. You know, I oftentimes talk on the floor and in committee, I talk about the strong men that I had in my life. What I don't often get to talk about are some of the strong Black men teachers that I had in my life. And there weren't many. Even though I grew up in a community where many of the people looked like me, many of my teachers were strong Black women, which I greatly appreciated. But what I didn't have, I can count on one hand how many Black male teachers that I had in front of me leading the classroom. But what I do know, when I had those teachers in front of me, it was a different feeling that I had when I came into that classroom. There were different conversations that I had with those teachers after class. And there were different engagements that I had with those teachers during class. All positive, all pushing me to be the best that I can be, all encouraging me and letting me know that I could be successful in this world, regardless of what challenges were stacked against me. Black Men Teach seeks to bring more Black men into the classroom to do just that, to have that impact, positive impact on our young Black men and our young Black women and our students of color in our classroom. As we know in Minnesota, we have these huge disparity rates, but we also know that the data tells us when we have teachers that look like our students, there are better positive outcomes that will happen and better educational attainment that will happen for those students. So I'll end briefly with that introduction because I do have some great testifiers here. I have the executive director, Marcus Flynn, of Black Men Teach, and I also have a couple of the testifiers as well. So with that, Madam Chair, I will yield for testimony.
Thank you. Go ahead, state your name for the record and proceed.
Chair Ewell Kim and members of the committee, thank you for giving me an opportunity to support Black Men Teach, tell you about some of our past successes, and a little bit of our vision for the future. My name is Marcus Flynn. I'm the executive director of Black Men Teach. Our mission is to recruit, prepare, place, and retain Black male teachers in elementary schools. In Minnesota, having a Black man lead an elementary school classroom is both an incredibly beneficial experience for everybody, but it's also an incredibly unique one. We estimate that less than half of 1% of all of the teachers in the state of Minnesota are Black men. When Black men do teach, both the data and the anecdote are compelling. We know Black students in classrooms with Black teachers stay in school longer and go further in their education. Being a former teacher myself and now having access to many more classrooms, I could tell you many stories of parents and even students coming to me and talking about how impactful it is for them to see somebody, to have someone in their classroom who reflects their identity. You know, honestly, much of my ability to tell you all stories like this is due to the previous support that we received from the legislature. In 2021, we were fortunate to receive an appropriation of $750,000. That funding was restricted to our programmatic efforts, and it was instrumental to our growth. At the time, back in 2021, we had one full-time staff. It was just me. We have four today. In 2021, we had seven program participants, six in college, one in the classroom. Now we have closer to 70. We're here today seeking a reinvestment to allow us to continue our growth and progress towards our ultimate goal. The funding we're requesting will allow us to alleviate financial barriers for men through scholarships, student teaching stipends, and through loan forgiveness. It'll allow us to continue supporting our pre-service and classroom teachers with mentorship and professional development. It'll allow us to build a literacy enrichment program where our pre-service teachers can learn how to deliver reading instruction to struggling readers aligned with the science of reading. It'll allow us to provide critical recruitment and retention incentives like our home equity program and to continue to build out our staff so, again, we can reach that ultimate goal. So, again, Chair Uekim and committee members, thank you for allowing me to share about Black Men Teach, and I stand for questions.
Thank you. Next up, we have Amy Oliver and then Daryl Hughes. Why don't you, Daryl Hughes, why don't we have you all come up? Go ahead, Amy Oliver, state your, Principal Oliver, state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amy Oliver. Thank you for the opportunity to highlight the success of our three-year partnership with Black Men Teach. Again, my name is Amy Oliver, and I'm the principal at Monroe Elementary in Brooklyn Park. We serve 70% students of color and a staff that was mostly white. Since working with Black Men Teach, we have increased our number of black male educators from 0 to 4, and now nearly 25% of our staff are people of color. One story I can share with you is related to a young man who was at our school as a kindergartner. He struggled with behavior and learning, missing a significant amount of instructional time. Obviously, this negatively impacted his achievement. Utilizing all of our resources to support him, we still saw very little growth. However, when he joined a classroom led by one of our black male educators, there was a dramatic shift. He was now able to remain in the classroom. He became a reader. He grew in confidence and developed a relationship with his teacher and with others that allowed him to thrive. There are still hard days, but I have no doubt that this student's life has been changed by having a teacher with whom he could identify and connect. This organization is making it possible for us to build a network of black male educators committed to making schools a better place.
Thank you. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Hello, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Darrell Hughes, and I would like to thank you all for giving me the opportunity to support Black Men Teach and share with you my testimony titled Hear None, See None, Yet Become. If you all could do me a favor after today's hearing, of course, and locate a white teacher between the ages 25 and 65 and tell them that I'm looking for them. Now, I know that's a broad range of people. You know, so many fit this description. In fact, I'm confident that all of you today on the panel or in this room know at least one person in your family, peer group, or profession that is a white teacher. How encouraging for two-thirds of my white classmates growing up to see themselves every day in this role. But what about the remaining one-third of my black classmates specifically? Is there room for me, is my question. Scripture says faith comes by hearing the word, and I've heard many things through my adolescent years. You can be a star athlete. You can get a job. You can provide for your family. You could do whatever you put your mind to. Whatever I put my mind to, well, that could be easily whatever. I've also heard, contrarily, the phrase, seeing is believing. Word. So, yes, I've seen star athletes. I've seen men work and provide for their families, my mother providing for me, and I've seen all sorts of jobs. Yet neither have I heard I could be a teacher nor seen a black male as my teacher. So then is it hard to believe that out of all my black classmates, K through 12, that none of them went on to pursue a career in education? How discouraging. That is until I heard of a particular program, Black Men Teach Twin Cities. I need your help today. Through my experience with Black Men Teach Twin Cities, it has shown me it's possible. Black Men Teach Twin Cities has told me it's possible. And today, you all, with your help, can make me become possible a teacher. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. With that, members will... Don't have any, those in the public signed up to testify, so we'll go to questions at the table or comments. Representative Hudella.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really want to commend this group. Not only is it great education, I heard a reference to the science of reading, which is awesome. I'm the guy in the room that always checks out financials and transparency for a lot of the nonprofits and the groups that come through, and just really want to commend you on transparency, listing your 990 on your site. Financials look good. I'd support this group 100%, and would just like to state for our group and Madam Chair, this is how nonprofits should look when they come through here. Incredible transparency, and just really a great, great group. And again, thanks for including the science of reading.
Thank you. Representative Bakeberg.
All right. Yeah, I would echo what Representative Hudela spoke about. And really my question is for Ms. Oliver. And I'm a building principal as well. And honestly, I've never heard of Black Men Teach and have the same struggles that you have. So maybe more of, and maybe it's with our associations, of just marketing and getting the group more known. Because if you're looking for a job, I'll hire you. So, so thank you.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier. I am such a huge fan of Black Men Teach, and so thank you for all of your work. I remember my first year as a therapist. I was at Washburn Center for Children, and we had a classroom of about six kids, and they were, like you, they were dealing with a lot of behavior stuff that was going on. And we had the teacher, Mr. Donnie, was a Black man, and those six kids' face would light up when he walked in the room. And he truly helped change their lives. It wasn't necessarily me as a, you know, therapist with my master's degree. It was him. And so the work you do is so incredibly important. And so thank you.
Thank you. With that, Representative Shrega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Frazier. We talk about this a lot in the work that we do and the importance of our children. We know what it feels like when we see someone reflect where we come from and deal with the issues. It's that booster that we need in an education system so that we can fulfill our highest potential. And I want to say, Mr. Hughes, thank you for sharing your testimony. It's about connecting to grow. And if we're not connected to folks that can give us a boost of mentorship while getting through the struggles of every day and trying to make the education system better, then we're losing. And this is an opportunity for all of us to win. Thank you.
Thank you so much. With that, Representative Frazier, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for your...
Representative Krisha.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, Representative Frazier. And I'm wondering if the director can come back up. I'm sorry, I thought I...
Yeah, I didn't...
My apologies.
Sorry, I didn't see your hand.
So a couple of things... great work, obviously. There are a lot of things. So, but I'm just looking at some of the logistics and help me understand a couple things. And I look at 1.13 on the first page, so 121. And this is just for my understanding clarification. So you've got 20% of employees. Why that number? Is that an empirical number? Is that a PFA number, which we do all the time, a pulled from air number? Why that number? Why is that an important number?
Mr. Flynn, go ahead.
State your name for the record again. Thank you, Chair Uakim. Marcus Flynn is my name. Can you, Representative
Krisha?
Krisha, yes, can you ask that question one more time?
Sure. What I'm just looking at, you've got a number here of, it says on line 1.15, number of Black male teachers to 20% of the employees for each school site. I'm just curious why that number, and really, just to let you know where my line of questioning is going, I want to make sure your program's successful. And I want to make sure we're not just ending up with arbitrary numbers that can create non-success metrics. So I'm curious about that number.
Thank you, Chair Uakim. So this number is about our partner schools. So in the schools that we partner with, we want to have 20% of their teaching staff being Black men. And it's not about the entire state of Minnesota. That'd be a significantly larger number that we'd have the capacity to do in a reasonable timeline. So our goal is to have 8 schools and 20% of their teaching staff be Black men by the school year 2025-26. So we're thinking about a 3-year runway of how do we get to that point. And that number was chosen because it felt like a critical mass where you can see that collegial support existing in the school buildings, but then also not a number that's so ambitious it's not possible, right? And so we picked that number that probably equates to somewhere based on the general size of an elementary school, about 6 teachers. And so we're thinking about being in the ballpark of, on the low end, 32, on the high end, like 38 black male elementary school teachers. But again, that number in itself might not feel big, but the 2019 Pelsby Biennial Supply and Demand Report said there's 63,436 active teachers. 875 are black. That's 1.4%. And it said they don't stratify by race and gender, but if you look the proportion of men to women, there's roughly 1 out of 4 teachers in the state of Minnesota are men. So you take that same proportion, apply that to 875, talking about 220 black male teachers, and that's K-12. We think about elementary school specifically, probably nationally 89% of all elementary school teachers are women. So a conservative estimate probably would be about 50 black male elementary school teachers in the state of Minnesota when we started our work, and we're talking about increasing that number by 80-90% in a 5-year window.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you. And follow. So that's awesome. That's the kind of concrete things I'm looking for. In fact, I would be more inclined to go with that. I mean, if you came back and said you had a number of 50 increase, that'd be awesome. You may want to consider this goes forward. You say 20% of employees versus you're talking teaching staff. I would clarify that just so that you don't get caught up in the dilution of the entire, employee pool. A second question, just quickly. You mentioned sites in greater Minnesota suburban areas and urban settings. Can you give me the clarification you just gave for that metric? I mean, you really honed it in for me on the number of teachers you want. What concrete clarification? What would you consider to be success for rural, suburban, so other sites? Are you just going to go out to Monticello? You're going to go to Foley? What is your grand plan?
Mr. Flynn.
Terry Ukim, thank you. And then Representative Crenshaw, thank you for the question again. I think right now the focus is primarily the Twin Cities Metro. So we have partnerships within the actual, like, Minneapolis proper, and then we're moving outside to, like, Anoka Hennepin, where Amy is. We have partnerships in Hopkins right now, Columbia Heights, developing partnerships with Osseo, so a few other suburban sites. And I think once we can operate to fidelity, then it feels a little bit more attainable to move to maybe St. Cloud before we get all the way out to Monticello. And to be fair, I don't even know where Monticello is right now. So I think we have a little bit of work we need to do to just make sure that everything we do, we can replicate it in greater Minnesota. But the need is everywhere, right? There's students of color everywhere. And so we want to be able to take that model and move it out. But it's just step by step.
Lesson.
Thank you, Representative Fisher.
And thank you, Madam Chair. So what you just said there, and I would recommend to the bill author, go back and tighten the language up between 113 and 121. What you just said there to me is, the red flag is this. You said, well, I'm not even sure where Foley is or this. I think of the Swanvilles, the Randalls, the Upsells of the world. And what I would say is really know the area and make sure you define where you're going. So that in a year or 2 years from now, whoever's sitting here can't say to you, well, the line says you must include, but you didn't. And I don't want to set you up for that next ask, and I don't want you to set you up for problems down the road. So be deliberate and be intentional about where you're going, and we'll support that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Mr. Flynn, I have one question, too, and I don't want to make assumptions, but is saying employees, because some of your candidates might have to work as a para during the day and then move into the programming, into teaching. Is that why you say employees instead of just teachers?
Thank you for the question, Chair Ukim. So our goal is about the teaching staff. We do have a lot of men. Darrell is one of them who currently works as a paraprofessional. But the goal is to get 20% of their teaching staff. So that's the only number that we're really counting. So it's just a mistake on our part.
Okay, got it. Thank you. With that, members, any other questions? Final comments, Representative Frazier.
Yeah, and I would like to address Representative Kreisoff, your question about the broadness of where the program can be. The language does say to the extent possible, black men teach must include sites in greater Minnesota. The idea is for growth. And I think what Representative Bakeford said about the fact that you haven't heard of the program, now you have. The idea is to start building those relationships, and this appropriation would allow the ability to grow. So it's to the extent possible because they want to grow, and we're hoping we can build more relationships so they have those opportunities. That's why it had that extent possible as a flexibility to allow that, so not to put them in a box, but they can focus on having the opportunity to grow. So I just wanted to clarify that for you in the language. And we can absolutely address the piece around the 20% employees versus faculty and the staff. But members, thank you for the comments. Thank you for the questions. Thank you for the support. And allow me to present this bill along with the executive director, with Ms. Oliver, and then also with that brilliant oratory work that you did. I appreciate that. And that's the kind of talent we want to have in our classroom. That's the kind of thing we want our young men, our young people to see that they can aspire to be. It's making me excited. I just can't say enough that this is a good program, and I hope we can get the support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. And you know I love paras since I am one, so they're still awesome employees. With that, members, I'll lay over House File 2214 for possible inclusion in the education finance bill. Next up, we have got House File 2696, Representative Greenman. Representative Greenman, welcome to your committee. Would you like to move House File 2696 before the committee for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is my motion.
Thank you. With that, Representative Greenman, the bill is before us. Go ahead and start.
Well, thank you so much, members, and I'm really excited. This is a bill that I am excited to carry and present. What this bill does is it funds the Minnesota Civic Education Coalition, which is a coalition of organizations, and specifically this grant would be for the Learning Law and Democracy Foundation, the University or the YWCA Center for Youth Voice, and the what most folks know, we've seen all the kids around the Capitol, the Youth in Government program. As a voting rights lawyer and as someone who's been in this work a long time, what I know is that the practice of our democracy is much deeper than just pulling that lever. It's about all the ways that we learn to participate, to come together, to make good decisions together, and the exciting things about these programs, the exciting things where I think we have probably lots of alumni of youth in government in the legislature, is that it is an opportunity for our young folks to get out there to practice and to learn sort of experientially, to learn how our democracy works, to learn the roles. And as a freshman legislator who did not do youth in government as a young person, I think I would have come in with a lot more skills and a lot more things that I had to pick up on the job. So I think I will not say much more because we have some great testifiers who can really tell us the impact. But what I would say is I know that the issue of and the investment in civics education has been both a bipartisan commitment and passion of many folks. And I think what I appreciate about these programs is it really allows folks to go and get their hands, young people to get their hands into that work of civics education. So with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to our two testifiers.
Thank you. I've got Amy Anderson and Upshira Hauser. Go ahead, state your name for the record. Proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for inviting us to testify today on behalf of House File 2696. My name is Amy Anderson, and I'm the Executive Director of the YMCA Center for Youth Voice and Youth in Government. I'm also representing the Minnesota Civic Education Coalition today, whose partners have worked collaboratively to develop and deliver high-quality civic programming for more than 10 years. I'm guessing that just about everybody here in this room shares the goal of raising young people to become good citizens. Not in the legal sense, but we want to raise children who are respectful to others, who care about their communities, who take a stand for things they oppose, and advocate for issues that are important to them. But raising good citizens doesn't just happen automatically. I'm a parent, maybe many of you are here,
Just like we teach our children to brush their teeth, eat healthy foods, exercise, get enough sleep, we hope they have good study skills, we teach them these things. We also need to help them develop the knowledge, skills, and motivation to participate in civic life. Preparing all students for informed, engaged participation in civic and democratic life is not only essential, but is consistent with the aims of increasing student achievement and closing achievement gaps. It is also consistent with preparing students for 21st century careers. The Minnesota Civic Education Coalition works on two fronts to ensure that Minnesota students receive well-rounded, high-quality civic learning experiences. First, we develop and deliver training and support to K-12 teachers to help them deliver the experiences. And we provide resources like teachingcivics.org, where they can go and find high-quality lessons. Second, we offer supplemental programs like Students Voting, Youth Day at the Capitol, Respectful Conversations in Schools, and, of course, Youth in Government, that allow students to further expand their civic learning outside the classroom. But rather than me take up a lot of time talking about the impact of our work, I'd like to introduce you to Abshir Hauser, who's participated in not one, not two, but three YMCA Center for Youth Voice programs over the past couple of years. Abshir is a senior at Higher Ground Academy in St. Paul, and he's also taken on a leadership role with our Student State Steering Committee. He is here today to tell you what he has learned through his involvement in our civic learning programs and why he believes that civic education is so important.
Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and the members of the committee. My name is Abshir Hauser. I am a senior who attends Higher Ground Secondary Academy. I have been to many CYV events and activities like Youth in Government, Model United Nations, twice in fact, National Judicial Competition, or otherwise known as NJC. I will also be attending this upcoming CONA, or otherwise known as Conference on National Affairs. I've only been doing CYV activities since March 2022, and I've learned so much. I engage with new people, and I never met with, and people from different backgrounds. I'm also part of the State Steering Committee, which concludes with representatives from different schools who come together 4 to 5 times a year and work together to make youth in government and other CYV activities better and connect with other delegations known as schools to allow more people to acknowledge CYV activities and possibly one day be a part of it. I also took it upon myself at last year's State Fair to volunteer and speak at the CYV booth and promote its activities. I love getting to tell people about things like youth in government and Model UN, for them to get interested and possibly sign their own children up one day, and for other children who are in grades 7 to 12 to sign up. I believe that the civic learning programs that the CYV provides are 100% beneficial, and if not, life-changing. Civic education through the CYV has opened many doors to opportunities and topics I have never known or even acknowledged. In a short span of a year, I have met and made over 100 new friends and learned and debate about topics varying from undocumented immigrants being allowed to have an education in the U.S. to things like why Russia and Russia-Ukrainian war should end, and other things like starving communities in the world in specific areas. I never had any interest in the government field prior to doing CYV activities, but it has shown me a new aspiration, and I hope one day I can be a part of government and make a change to our state, country, and the world. Thank you for your time and for allowing me to present this statement.
Thank you for your testimony and for being so actively engaged. With that, members, do we have any questions or comments at the table? Everybody's very quiet this morning. Representative Greenman, final comments.
Well, thank you. Chair, I hope that you are thinking about maybe joining us here one day in the legislature, because you will certainly come well prepared. I think what you just heard is the really importance of this investment to building that foundation within kids, within communities, and across Minnesota, of the experiential experience of actually learning how to practice democracy and learning how our government works, learning how communities can come together and build together and make decisions together, solve problems together, and also, and I think you heard this from both of them, about the impact that it has on individual kids, students in our district. So with that, Madam Chair, I hope everyone will support this in our potentially being included on our omnibus, and I'd move for it to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. House File 2696 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill. With that, we have House File 2131 up next. Good morning, Representative Hicks. Welcome to the Education Finance Committee. And let's see here. We have, getting to the right space, Representative Pryor, would you like to move House File 2131 before the Education Finance Committee?
So moved, Madam Chair.
With the intention of laying it over for possible inclusion in the education bill. Thank you. Representative Hicks, your bill is before us. Go ahead and proceed.
Thank you so much, Chair and committee members. I really appreciate your willingness to hear this bill today. The Alliance of Chicos, Hispanics, and Latin Americans is a nonprofit organization that serves Latina Minnesotans in Rochester in the critical areas of education. This organization has provided support in my community for many, many years and is an invaluable asset. Their mission is to empower Hispanics to participate in enriching the quality of life in the Rochester area through educational opportunities, civic engagement, community-wide partnerships, and collaboration. They also do amazing work in cultural exchange and building capacity within our community. The purpose of this funding and this ask today is to allow their Juntos program to provide support to migrant and immigrant children that experience low levels of educational attainment and enrichment activities to improve overall educational outcomes. This club has been a tutoring program that reaches out into our diverse communities in Rochester area for the last 19 years. The goal of the program is to create an educational platform that provides access to information, resources, advocacy, and opportunities for our children, youth, and families. I have had the pleasure of working with this organization for many years, and the work that they do to empower our youth is so, so important in our community. And so I will turn it over to my testifiers to share more details about this amazing program.
Thank you. With that, the testifiers I have on my list here are Daniel Goodwin, Rebecca Sudarsky, Miriam Goodson, and Gloria Torres-Herbeck. Why don't we start out with Daniel Goodson, I have. Or however you'd like. Go ahead and just state your name for the record. State your name for the record and then proceed.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gloria Torres-Herbeck. I am ACLAS President of the Board of Directors. Thank you, everyone, for giving us the opportunity to share our story and why our work matters to our students and families in the southern Minnesota. ACLAS has made a difference in the lives of the students and families for the last 19 years. It is important to share with you that we haven't done this alone. We have developed and created networks and partnerships with multicultural liaisons and advocacy that serves the underserved communities in our area. Some of the examples of these partnerships are Mayo Clinic, Rochester Community and Technical College, Rochester Public Schools, ACER, IBM, and many others. But something that I wanted to share because it moved me is that did you know that in the Department of Education report card, 61% of sixth grade Hispanic students do not meet the standards. But this is a state level, but 92% in the Rochester area of the Hispanic students do not meet the standards. This is very concerning for all of us and what it represents to our students and our children. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, the 100 families and students participating in the Juntos program, which means together, Juntos means together in Spanish, benefiting by going to English classes, math tutoring, health initiatives, connecting them to enrichment activities and youth programming. Once the pandemic hit, we have to suspend temporarily the Juntos program. Unfortunately, this left families and students participating in the Juntos program without needed education and support services. As you know, already existing education disparities among students of color and immigrant students and compared to the white counterparts was further worsened by the pandemic. We noticed that the effects of COVID-19 and on the MCA sixth grade math state report from 2020. It shows a constant drop over each grade level in the Hispanic group since the pandemic. I'm a teacher, and I see this firsthand. And I wish to be able to help all of them. I'm gonna pass the microphone to my friend, a co-founder of the Juntos program, to continue to talk about this effort.
Thank you so much. And before I move on, we have two other bills to get to too, so if you can keep your comments brief to like 2 minutes, that'd be great. Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Miriam Lopez Daumas Goodson, and thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Finance Committee. I appreciate this panel that is advocating for educational programs, so thank you so much. I am also in the educational panel system, and I've been there for years, so I have witnessed, and I am a woman of action. So for years, we do partner with people to be able to reach out to our community. So one of the points that I want to make here is that the four-year graduation in Rochester for Hispanic students dropped more than 13 points between 2020 and 2021. So that means that we have a lot of work to do again after the pandemic disaster. Through our shared experience, we acknowledge that for us to close the opportunity gaps that exist, we need to work of connectors and navigators, educational navigators that look like us to help children succeed. The Juntos program is an excellent example of this action. We need your help and ask that you partner with us to make sure that all children succeed in southern Minnesota. And I would like to say a quote, if you talk to a man in a language he understands, that goes to his head. So Nelson Mandela said, if you talk to him in his own language, that goes to his heart. Thank you. And I'll pass the baton to Rebecca.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Sadarsky. I am an ACLA board member as well and past president. Before I begin my testimony, I would like to pass, I know that I didn't speak with the committee administrator, but I have copies for all of you of of all the letters of support that we have, and also I want to let you know that there is a QR code there where you can go and see more of the videos that some of the testifiers that are not here that wanted to support our bill as well is in that QR code, as so you can review it later. But there are some at least five letters of support. So it is a great honor for me to be here and testify. ACLA's organization was created because of the educational disparities among the Hispanic students and families in Minnesota. ACLA's board is made of now 13 dedicated Latino leaders ready to increase the impact with Southern Minnesota and expand services to students and families in need. Throughout ACLA's educational reach, we have witnessed many of our students complete their higher education dreams and are now contributing members of our communities. Currently, Rochester's population includes roughly 6% of our Latino-Hispanic Minnesotans. Many of our families and children are disconnected from traditional support systems, and this funding will allow us to reach them in a culturally appropriate way. At this time, there are approximately 35 Hispanic Latino children that are not registered for kindergarten in the Rochester public schools and need those navigation systems to be ready in the fall. As you all know, This will affect the children's educational outcomes in the long run. And now, if you permit me, I would like to present Enrique Zavala's video testimony.
I'm so sorry, we really don't have time for that.
Okay.
We have one more testifier here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Then I'll turn it over to you.
Sorry. Thank you. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Daniel Goodson. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for this opportunity. I am the CFO and owner of Breaking Barriers, a disability waiver service provider for the Dakota County area and soon to serve the Olmsted County area as well. More importantly, I am here as a representative of OCLA, where I serve further on the board of directors. I immigrated here at 9 years old, and although I was educated, I did not possess the English acumen of my peers, nor did I understand the cultural environment that I was coming into. The formal education system provided special education interventions and ML, previously in my day known as ESOL. And by all means, these classes supported me. They did help bring me through, but it was not enough for my mother's vision of equality. I think everybody here has kind of put two and two together in that kind of way as well. Right? Hence the genesis of the Juntos program, which was designed with the intention of being able to provide a culturally appropriate and familiar environment for then Latino and Hispanic children and now families to better integrate into the expectations of our educational school system. I can proudly say, along with my brother Enrique Zavala's testimony, which I believe is in the QR code as well.
Correct.
So I'm a Juntos success story in that way. Seeing it now more clearly than ever, I do believe that many immigrants, like myself, do not just need inclusive classes. We also need the time with caring adults in enrichment programs like Juntos to be able to feel like we really belong in the educational system. Being propelled forward by this program and being part of a field that aims to educate and provide services, I can now come back to my community well-equipped to contribute to OCLA's mission, which, as you all know, is to enrich the lives of the Hispanic community through critically important engagements like the Juntos program. The trust that OCLA has built over the last 20 years is what allows it to be successful in its efforts. And receiving this funding would only help us continue to build these essential bridges for integration, as they are very much so needed. At this point, statewide, 16.3% of Latino students pass a statewide proficiency test. This is cut in half in Rochester. This is 7.9% for the Rochester Public School District. The disparities that I encountered back in the 90s are still absolutely present and recognizable today. In this, it is in the power you have, Madam Chair, along with this committee, to be able to empower this effort so we may better endure and be equipped to fight the systemic discrepancies our people face. Thank you.
Thank
you,
sir.
We are incredibly grateful for not only the opportunity to advocate these critical needs, but for your consideration.
Thank you so much. With that, members, do we have any questions or comments? Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks, and our Minnesotans from the Rochester Minnesotanos for being here. This is extremely important to support. I look forward to supporting this. We know that language is the key in building community, and I have seen, I have lived to see Rochester's largely and fast, rapidly growing Latino community. If we don't stop the barriers of, you know, that are blocking our communication for our children and for our elders to be a part of literacy programs to advance knowledge and skills, then we're blocking opportunity in general for the full community of Minnesota. So gracias por estar aquí. It's very important, and it's lovely to see all of you, and I look forward to seeing some of our Rochester members soon. Thanks.
Es nuestro honor. Gracias.
Thank you. Representative Adela.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for bringing the bill, Representative Hicks. Seems like a great group, and just a couple of quick questions, if I may. Are you guys set up as a nonprofit organization in Minnesota?
Whoever wants to answer that, just state your name for the record and proceed.
Gloria Torres Herbeck. Yes, we are. We are a nonprofit organization, and we have 13 volunteers that we work after work to run this organization.
Thank you, Representative Adela.
one more follow-up. We always look to try and make sure, hey, are we appropriating money to not only groups that are a great cause, which it seems like you are, but groups that have just a solid financial position in our filing forms correctly. So I couldn't find you on the Secretary of State's website. I couldn't find any IRS tax filings. So just curious if you're set up as a nonprofit organization, if somebody could just address how you're filing and then if we could request a copy of their most recent returns.
Yes.
Thank you.
Miriam can answer that.
Thank you.
She's in the finance.
Miriam Lopez Daumas Goodson, and again, this organization is run with volunteers. I am a volunteer. And we receive funding normally from Mayo Clinic, different, and we do have, we have been serving with a 990 postcard for the last so many years, but this year we have an accountant working for us so we can, we are registered at the state, but we are not still yet paying taxes on the state or paying taxes because it's a nonprofit organization. But those questions, I'll be glad to provide them with the accountant because she's the one that running the books.
Thank you, Representative Hidalgo.
And just one last point. The postcard returns, if I remember right, the threshold's $50,000 to file
yes.
that simpler mm-hmm. return. So mm-hmm. We're looking at appropriating much more mm-hmm. than that. So appreciate you guys taking the steps with an accounting firm to get the filing done. And again, would love to just see a copy once that filing is complete. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hidalgo.
Thank you.
With that, I don't see any other further questions or comments. Representative Hicks, final comments.
Thank you so much, Chair. So my passion for this organization comes from the fact that as a middle-class white lady, I had no concept of how significant the discrepancies were in our community. And then 7 years ago, God and the universe decided that I needed to parent children who were Latina. And I suddenly was thrown into a world that I didn't understand and that I had no knowledge of the discrepancies and the barriers. And as soon as I recognized the barriers and the discrepancies, I am also a woman of action. And so I got to work trying to find who are the people in our community that are doing the work to break down those barriers and how can I support them. And this is the next step of that journey, and we would greatly appreciate your support as we move forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. With that, I'll move House File 2131 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill. Next up, we have Representative Aiken with House File 2398. Thank you, Representative Aiken. Welcome back to the committee. Representative Fryer, will you move House File 2398 before the committee today?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fryer. And with that, Representative Aiken has an A2 amendment. Will you please move that as well?
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Aiken, would you like to describe the A2 amendment?
Yes, please. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So the A2 makes a couple of technical changes and then just changes, allows the Department of Health to identify training materials for schools rather than producing them themselves.
Thank you, Representative Aiken. With that, members, are there any questions on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The A2 amendment's adopted. Representative Pryor, proceed. Or Representative Aiken, proceed.
We both represent parts of Minnetonka, so it's easy to get us confused. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 2398 today. It's a bill that provides naloxone to schools. So here's what we know. Last year, the Centers for Disease Control reported the most overdose deaths ever recorded in a single year in the United States. In Minnesota, we saw a 49% increase in fatal overdoses in teens. One in seven young adults has a substance use disorder. An overdose is the number one cause of death for young people in the United States. There is no denying it. We need to act with urgency to address this important issue. Thankfully, we have an important tool to help in this fight. Naloxone is a relatively inexpensive medication that is simple to administer. It's safe, and most importantly, it saves lives. Naloxone reverses the effects of opioids and stops an overdose. Given the statistics I just referenced about use among our young people, we need to make sure that naloxone is widely available in order to save lives. Having it accessible in schools is important to ensure that no student dies of an overdose. This bill has evolved over several years and was previously carried in the House by our former colleague, Dr. Kelly Morrison, who is now serving in that other body. Dr. Morrison developed this bill with her constituent, who's here with me today, Colleen Ronnie, who herself lost a son to overdose. Ms. Ronnie has made educating kids about opioids and preventing overdose her life's mission. She founded Change the Outcome, a nonprofit that aims to combat the substance use and overdose epidemic through education initiatives for young people. She's been in many schools across our state, reaching thousands of young people. This bill has been worked on collaboratively with advocates, MDE, MDH, school nurses, superintendents, and school boards. I am proud to join the effort this year with the hope that with your help, we can get this bill across the line. So at that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Ronnie, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Colleen Ronnie. I am the founder and executive director of Change the Outcome. As Representative Acomb mentioned, I'm also a parent who has lost a child to the opioid epidemic. Our son Luke was 20.
I'm sorry, I'm tired. I don't cry all the time. But he was 20 years old when he experienced an overdose in our home in 2016. His substance use disorder began in high school when he was prescribed opioids for pain after his wisdom teeth were removed. I've spent the years since then educating young people about the opioid epidemic and middle and high school students and educators across the state with an extraordinary team of young people in recovery and young people who have been impacted by a loved one's opioid use. We've met with more than 70,000 students in the last 6 years. Every week we're seeing firsthand the precarious situation that almost every high school is facing because of the absence of this simple life-saving tool. The opioid epidemic has expanded and changed in many ways over the past decade. Few of those changes have been good. This public health crisis is growing worse every day due to the inclusion of fentanyl in the drug supply, and it is taking a toll on young people at greater and faster rates than ever before. It's a common misperception among young people that pills are a safer option when trying substances. 6 months ago, the DEA warned the public that 4 out of 10 pills had a potentially lethal amount of fentanyl in them. Last month, that number jumped to 6 out of 10 pills have a potentially lethal amount. 53% of 25,000 kids that we presented to in the last 2 years have no idea that pressed pills even exist. They don't even know that they're a thing. So they can't possibly know that they're a danger. I think most of us have seen in the news with increasing and alarming frequency the incidents across the country involving high schools where a student overdoses, some fatally. In some cases, it's educators. Sadly, overdoses are occurring in middle and high schools in Minnesota. Despite that, we've not taken the necessary steps to respond in a way that could prevent a future tragic fatality. Our schools are not required to carry this life-saving tool, despite the fact that we are in the midst of a fentanyl crisis and
Overdoses are the leading cause of death for young people. We do not have a national epidemic of heart attacks, yet we require all public schools in Minnesota to have an operational AED on school grounds at all times. Additionally, all schools are required to train employees with appropriate life-saving skills like CPR and the use of an AED. The average cost of an AED is $2,000. The average cost of this is $23. It's really cheap. If you lost a child to an overdose, you would know it's not only reckless, but heartless to continue to deny the critical need for this practical solution in our schools. Schools are gathering places, and in many towns, they are the heart of the community where tens of thousands of people spend a majority of their day. I've talked to hundreds of educators who have expressed a genuine fear that a student will overdose in their school or a classroom, and they will be powerless to help. Several have asked how they can get their schools to adopt a naloxone policy. Many have privately asked us to leave them with naloxone, even though they know that if they ever had to use it, they would risk losing their jobs. There are more than 330 school districts in Minnesota, and fewer than 30 have a naloxone policy. We've been lucky so far in terms of not losing a young person to an overdose in one of our schools, but our luck will run out if we don't act now and pass this legislation this year. Thank you for an opportunity
to talk about it. And I am so sorry for your loss. Next up, we have Tucker Robinson.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to testify today. My name is Tucker Robinson, and I'm a lead program facilitator at Change the Outcome. In this role, I've been afforded the opportunity to speak in numerous high schools across Minnesota about the opiate epidemic. However, I'm not just here to testify as a member of the Change the Outcome team. I'm also here to testify as a person in recovery. As of November of 2022, I had 5 years in recovery from opioid use disorder and substance use disorder. Given the nature of the bill that we're discussing, I'd like to offer some of my history of use and some trends in teenage drug use that I've noticed have changed, as well as ones that have stayed consistent. I started using drugs when I was 13 years old. Initially, it was just alcohol and smoking marijuana. I was struggling with my mental health and issues at home at the time and felt like they provided me an escape. By the time I was 16, I had graduated to experimenting with several different substances, mostly pills like Adderall, Xanax, and Percocet. Over the next 2 years, much of my use took place on my high school campus. Teens today are still suffering from substance use disorder, opioid use disorder, and other co-occurring disorders. The teens that aren't dealing with these issues are likely to still experiment with drugs, whether this is because they desire an escape, outlet, or they're just watching their friends do it and believe it to be safe. Make no mistake, this is happening, and it's happening on school grounds. As for the things that have changed, the biggest one is the risk associated with using and experimenting with drugs. 10 years ago, while there was a risk associated with using substances, it wasn't nearly as high as it is currently. Fentanyl being cut into street drugs and pressed pills hadn't become the wildly abundant issue that it is today. When I purchased a pill, I knew what I was getting. Now pills and substances are marketed and sold as one thing, while they are almost always laced, cut, or just entirely fentanyl. Whether people and teens realize it or not, the drugs they are buying usually contain fentanyl, and when they ingest these quote-unquote drugs, it's much more likely to cause an overdose. And because of this, these overdoses are happening everywhere. Workplaces, parking lots, malls, our homes, even in our schools. As I've said, I've had the pleasure of speaking in several high schools across Minnesota over the last 6 months. When I think of these experiences, there's one in particular that stands out. About 3 months ago, we were speaking at a school in the greater Twin Cities area. During our presentation, a student raised his hand and announced in front of the class and to us that he couldn't stop using drugs. That student was inconsolable. When the teacher and I went to step out into the hallway with him, we learned that he had left during the presentation to go to the bathroom to drink the better portion of a bottle of vodka. While we were able to get him to a safe place, I was left thinking about how it could have been just as easy for that student to go to the bathroom and take some pill rather than drink vodka and never have left that bathroom again because the school we were at didn't have Narcan on hand. It is essential that this bill be passed and Narcan be mandated at schools across the country. There's no telling how many teen lives that it could potentially save. Personally, Narcan has both saved my life and the lives of many people that I know. Make no mistake, teens today are still suffering from substance use disorder. If they're not suffering from substance use disorder, they're likely to still experiment with drugs. Those drugs have a good chance of containing fentanyl in them, whether they know it or not, and that has a much higher chance of causing overdose. To mandate Narcan in schools would be a step in the right direction in both addressing the opiate epidemic and saving teen lives. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, and congratulations on 5 years. Members, are there questions or comments at the table? Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Acomb, for carrying this. I think this is very important. I'm sorry for the death of your son, and congratulations on your being sober, and I have a nephew who's working through that. This is such a huge issue. In Albert Lea, there was recently opened a naloxone access site through a different foundation, I think similar to yours, started with a son of somebody passing away, and they train people and give them naloxone. So I have a question. I fully support this, but just to have a question on how this works. The nasal naloxone, is that free, or is that generically available, or does one have to purchase the Narcan brand?
Whoever would like to answer.
This is Colleen Ronnie. Yes, it is generic now. It does not have to be the generic brand Narcan.
Thank you. Representative Bennett?
Thanks, Madam Chair, and that is awesome, because obviously the cost is huge, and I remember with, you know, EpiPens, when those were mandated for schools and suddenly the cost went up, you know, it's not a good thing. So good to hear that. The other question, or I guess just a comment to consider for your bill now or in the future, to put a permissive for schools to become a naloxone access site, so that being these people are going to be trained. Now, I know the access site in Albert Lea, by the way, we had a young man named, I just want to honor him, Manny Chavez, who passed away 16 years old last year in Albert Lea from a fentanyl overdose. Very sad. He was part of our church youth group. I didn't want to forget to mention his name. But just, I know ours is the injectable version in Albert Lea, but perhaps that training can take place as an access site for parents and people like that to come, get trained, and then have that in their home. Being we're starting this with schools, it seems like it might be a natural place to be an access site for future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. And I forgot we have a public testifier that I forgot to call up. So why don't we make some room and go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Kim Lewis, and I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And before I begin my remarks, I just want to again tell Colleen how sorry I am for her loss, and we've been testifying together for a couple of years. Thank you for allowing me time to address House File 2398. Representative Acomb and I have had conversations regarding the bill as well as Senator Morrison, and I look forward to continuing those. I just want to clarify that MSBA is not against this bill, but rather we want to ensure this bill, if passed, would be executed with fidelity. We do appreciate the funding that's attached with the bill as well. First, I'd like to share that MSBA has recently collaborated with the Minnesota Department of Health to create an MSBA MASA model policy. It's model policy number 516.5, to assist schools that may have or are considering overdose medication availability. MSBA has distributed that model policy to all of our members, all 331 school boards across Minnesota, within the last couple of weeks. MSBA's model policy offers guidance and support for Minnesota schools that choose to obtain, administer, and store naloxone, a medication designed to help reverse the effects of an opioid overdose in minutes. And the Minnesota Department of Health has just finalized a web-based naloxone school toolkit, which was launched Monday. It is an extensive resource that includes valuable information on opioid overdose, emergency response procedures in school settings, sample protocols and procedures, naloxone information, resources for education and staff training, resources for staff, student, parent prevention, and recovery and referral resources. House File 2398 requires the person having control of the school building must ensure that at least one staff member trained on how and when to administer nasal naloxone is on site when the school building is open to students, staff, or the public, including during before school, after school, or weekend activities. Outside of the school day, our buildings are very often used by community members and community organizations that school districts have no meaningful relationship with. There are community baseball teams, ball teams, Boy Scouts, and churches, for example, that use our buildings at night and on the weekends. This presents a problem in executing the expectations of the bill. Our concern is the bill's requirement presents an almost impossible standard for our schools because it requires at least one staff person on site when a school building is open to students, staff, or public. Districts would need to hire and train individuals for outside the regular school day. Another approach to achieving the goal of the bill would be to have every school adopt and implement a written overdose or Narcan plan, which would include the identification of a school nurse or designated individuals at each school site who are on duty during the regular school day and can administer or assist with the administration of the drug or medication to counteract the overdose. The plan should include training on the medications for employees the district identifies and the important ways to recognize signs and symptoms of an overdose and appropriate steps to respond to it. The plan could also include what happens outside of the regular school day, before classes begin in the morning and after school and weekends, and reflect local decision about how to meet the requirements of the bill. Our model policy does include specific outlines for a district planning team who would oversee the general development and operations related to the use of an opioid antagonist. We believe, again, that a local plan for during the regular school day is best. Again, outside of the school day, some schools may have an individual who is in the building at all times, but many don't. School districts could develop a plan that may include workable options such as providing instructions to the individual or groups when activities are scheduled, or the medication could be placed in an AED station if there is one. It's our understanding that there is no state requirement for schools to have an AED. I think there are ways we can certainly accomplish the goal, but to do so in a way that is workable in districts and school buildings. By putting together a locally developed action plan, districts would be in a much better place to implement and control the intended purpose of protecting students from overdose of narcotics. Thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Thank you so much. With that, we'll go back to our list. Representative Spencer Mura.
Thank you. I will keep my comments brief. I've had some conversations with Representative Akam about this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Akam, for bringing the bill. Thank you so much for sharing your story, and I'm so sorry for your loss, and thank you for doing this amazing work. I've had family members who have dealt with opioid addiction, got into it as young people, and so I think just the continued changing policies to our schools, you know, to meet the needs of our students is really necessary. I would like to, you know, continue to work on legislation surrounding this. You know, I think that there's more that we could do around fentanyl. I personally am trying to think about ways we can get fentanyl strips more accessible to everyone, including young people. So I would look forward to maybe continued conversations. But just thank you for this bill, and I am very much in support of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fadella.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to say thank you to everyone up there. This one hits home for me, especially 2020. Middle of the pandemic, I'll never forget. Late at night, my second oldest, who was a senior at Hastings High School, came running into our bedroom, flipped on the lights, bawling. His best friend, Tyler Kavitz, had just OD'd and died. So commend you on all the work, and I'll support it 100%.
Thank you. Representative Reed?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Acom, for bringing this forward. Thanks to Dr. Kelly Morrison for bringing it forward. I believe I spoke with Colleen Rane on the phone last year. I don't know if you remember that, but I heard your story. I'm very sorry about your loss. I fully support this. I think my only question would be, you know, why haven't we done this yet? You know, there's an urgency here. And even if this you know, having Narcan in the schools saves one life. You know, it's totally worth it. So I guess I would ask everyone to address this with the urgency it demands. And once again, thank you so much for bringing this forward, and thank you for championing this. Moms change the world, and you are changing things for the better. Thank you so much.
Thank you. With that, members, I think we'll go to final comments. Since we have one more bill, we're going to be running a few minutes late, but Representative Akam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the discussion today. And I just think that the discussion points to how this really touches all of us in one way or another. We all know someone close to us who has struggled with this issue. And so I thank you for your support, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you. With that, we'll move House File 2398 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill. And members, we have our final bill on the agenda with Representative Clardy, House File 2068. Thank you to the testifiers and the audience that have been waiting so patiently. Representative Clardy, welcome to your committee. Would you like to move House File 2068 before us for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill?
Yes, please move the bill.
Thank you. With that, the bill is before us, and go ahead and proceed.
Thank you. This bill we entitled Dreamland Program, and I'm excited to work with the Sunday Foundation and building the next generation of leaders. So this program actually started right down the road at St. Paul, in St. Paul Schools at St. Paul Park High School, and originally serviced like all St. Paul schools, but because of like the pandemic, they had to cut back on the services, and they lacked some adequate resources, and so that the services shrunk. The funding request today before you is for $2.5 million, and it will add to the base to ensure that this great program can get to more schools. And then not just more schools in St. Paul, but possibly expanded across the state. The Dreamland program works with schools to strengthen students' learning environment and support three core dimension areas. That's social, emotional, and then cognitive. So this program helps young people define their pathways to success by helping them engage with their peers in schools and communities, improves their physical and emotional well-being, discovers academic success and graduation from high school, and prepares them for life after school. So this program is amazing. It's amazing in the sense that it'll help promote equity and diversity and inclusion and social justice by empowering students with their social and emotional and academic skills they need to thrive. And at this point, Madam Chair, I would like to introduce the CEO, Tony Sane.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee and proceed.
My name is Tony Sane, and thank you for having me, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Years ago when I retired from professional soccer, I knew I wanted to come back and do something in the community, and then Assistant Superintendent Willie Jett, now State Commissioner of Education, helped me design a program going into one school. And it was amazing to find a man that gave me the courage to build something and mentored me through that process. So we built something in one school and used data. And that data got presented to three principals, eventually to seven. Years later, he got a superintendent job and left to St. Cloud and brought us with it. But it just goes to show you through leadership and investing in people, great things can happen. And now education is the flagship of our organization. People call me cheap. I would like to say we're fiscally efficient. When times are tough, we know we have to be present more values with the dollar. So that's what we do when we try to build this program. It is a dual track program, which means there's two sets of outcomes. We're investing in all of our caregivers, which 80% of them come from communities of color. First is we invest in our youth. And if you can see the sheet before you in our data, I think what's really important is 53% of decrease in referrals traditionally in all the schools we go to. And that's one from having more adults in the classroom to help the teachers, but also changing behavior in the students. One principal told me that, I didn't think it was great. He's like, you had a 60% change in 3 months. And he's like, those are 15 years of behavior that changed through the support. We also see a higher sense of belonging, and we're kidding ourselves if we don't agree with the effects of COVID is having on our community. Kids now coming back needing to be a part of something is really important to reduce violence. We know that mentoring is one of the greater protectives against depression and mental health issues, which is another challenge in our community right now. But our mentors also show up as classroom support for teachers and tutors, and most importantly, build relationships with our students. In our data that we've tracked over the years, we found out that 8 hours a year, that is the sweet spot. And it doesn't seem that much, but if we can spend 8 hours a year in building the relationship with the kids, we're going to see the highest academic outcomes. So whether we tutor the kids, do your homework every day for 2 hours, if we don't spend time getting to know them, it's just going to be activities that they're going to do. So we've used data to track what we're doing. We also think we've been good stewards of the money. We haven't sat still. We've grown. We've expanded in the past to Rochester, to St. Cloud, and we've expanded different areas in greater Minnesota and worked bipartisan to make sure. The second track is our pathway program. It's a dual track. We've graduated a class with master's degree students that are now teaching. We partner with University of College of St. Mary's. With there are no shortcuts, so they're all licensed teachers, and we created space for them to go and go to school during their training times on the job. A lot of times, you know, we get left out because people say we're not a culturally specific organization. We're a culturally inclusive organization, and that means that we're willing to work with anybody, anywhere. And we've been talking to schools across the state. One of the challenges is not having base funding since we've been funded, you know, over the last 7 years is, you know, there's times when the bill gets vetoed, and then what do? And we've had to scramble and do whatever we can to make it work. But because of that, we had to pull out of the Rochester School District. So, you know, it does cost money to start up in different areas of the state to build infrastructure and planning. And so we hope that we have continued support in the base so that we can be efficient with your dollars, build something to help our youth. You know, our greatest asset in the community is our kids. And it's amazing that we always take shortcuts on their caregivers, which you would think would be our greatest area of investment. I know all you on this committee because you believe in the power of education, and that's what we're trying to do. And so if you have any questions, I've brought in, and we look at ourselves as a business, so investing in talent, and we've brought one of the brightest minds in equity and education from the Minneapolis Public Schools, Candace here, to help answer any questions about the work we do.
Thank you, Mr. Sane. Candace, did you want, I'm sorry, I didn't hear your last name, did you want to introduce yourself for the record and say a few words? Or?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Candace Logan, and I'm the Executive Vice President, Executive Director of the Dreamline Program.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being here for questions. With that, members, questions or comments at the table? Representative Padilla.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You guys have been around for a long time, and I know you're a good group, familiar with you and some of your board members. I'll ask the same thing that I ask a lot of nonprofits coming through, though. Don't see a tax return, a 990 or audit online. I know the IRS is behind a bit. I would just ask, just given it's $5 million over 2 years, if you can submit to the committee most recent 990 and audit, I'd really appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Padilla, I'm going to start having to ask you for your CPA license. Mr. Sana.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Padilla. It's on GuideStar. An organization is redoing our website, and so we sort of stopped the updating it because we thought we were keep telling us it's a couple weeks out. But it is on GuideStar if you want to look it up there, but we can also send it to you. We're over 750. I think this year our budget is up to 8 million. So we've had clean audits for 7 years straight, and we're happy to show our financial transparency.
Thank you, Representative Padilla. Members, any other comments or questions? Representative Estrada.
Thank you, Chairwoman, and thank you, Representative Clardy and Tony. This is great, amazing work. We've seen the outcome in St. Paul. It should be statewide, and these are avenues to make it statewide. Kids deserve this. And I'm just so grateful for your leadership and community and championing and giving back. You know, we look at the success stories of what comes out from those St. Paul kids, those Minnesota kids, and you're always going to be the kid who gives back to the kid even as an adult. And it just is really monumental and very effective in our communities. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Perez-Vega. Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I won't say much. I just want to say thank you for Tony for being here, Representative Clardy for carrying this.
great organization. I'm very supportive. I love the data-driven examples that you have. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Bennett. Any other further comments or questions?
Madam Chair, can I,
Mr. Stanton,
can I ask a question? I just want to highlight, I'm a business guy. I want to be successful. I'm pushing. And I hired one of the brightest minds to come and really open my eyes. So I'd like to, ask Ms. Candace about just recognizing the trauma that this has caused in schools and why investing in our kids and what she's seen after COVID as she tries to explain to me sometimes when the bus is moving slow and I said, well, why isn't it faster? And from the academic sense, she can really articulate why our kids need this right now.
Thank you, Mr. Sane. Ms. Logan, go ahead and state your name for the record again and proceed.
Sure. Candace Logan, Madam Chair and committee members. First, I will say that I am a teacher. So I started as an educator in St. Paul Public Schools quite a bit ago. I've been a teacher for over 25 years. And so this work is real to me, is personal to me. I'm also a mother of a 15-year-old. So I know about the impact of, even before COVID, what the landscape of school was like for him, as well as for students once COVID hit us. And for some people, they said that COVID was the second pandemic. The first pandemic was racism. So as previous people have spoken at up here this morning, talking about the importance of representation and what it feels to have someone who either speaks the language that you speak, they have a shared identity, they look like you, they may come from the same community, they may have experiences, they may have experienced traumas that you also have experienced, and so there's a connection there. And often that is where I believe when we engage students, we first see them in all their humanness, and we encourage them to be unapologetically themselves. So we don't want them to leave any parts of themselves at the door when they come into the classroom. And in Dreamline, we say the same to our Dreamline mentors, because students will emulate what they see. So if they see mentors speaking their truth, being their unapologetic self, that sets the scene for students to feel that they can be their full selves. And then when that sense of safety has now been established, learning can happen. So we get to know students, we build relationships. We spend a lot of time talking about being trauma-informed, and you don't have to have had a traumatic experience personally to be impacted by what's happening. We all collectively have experienced the trauma of the pandemic, whether we've lost someone or we've lost connections with people because we can't be in a space with our loved ones if they already are immunocompromised. So there's always a sense of loss that we're talking about. And we're asking students to go back to normal in schools because there's toilet paper on the shelf at Target. There was a time when it wasn't, and we were really scared, weren't sure how this was going to last. But what students are telling us right now is they are still feeling the impact of being isolated for more than a year. And depending on how far out in the city they were, in the metro area, I know that students were out of school for about maybe a year and some months. But if you were in a more rural area, you might have been out for longer because you didn't have access to the same transportation, access to Wi-Fi. So our students across the state have been impacted. And I believe Dreamline is an opportunity to put mentors in schools who connect with the students without judgment. We talk about being our full unapologetic self, but then also leading with grace. So there's a lot that can be learned from our students who are ever resilient. They continue to come to school every day and figure out how to be together. And I get the privilege of leading a program that helps young people continue that in the classrooms with their students. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Members, any other further comments or questions? Representative Reed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Clardy, for bringing this forward. I hadn't heard of this program before, but it sounds amazing. And I loved what you said about how 8 hours of mentorship was the sweet spot. I think that's really interesting, and I'd love to hear more about that at some point. And I fully support programs like this. I think, what you've spoken about, this whole loss and grieving that we've gone through, it's so true. And I know there's something in here that you're planning on working on addressing the chronically absent students too, which I think is a huge issue. But anyway, I just want to say I fully support this and thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Ream. And with that, we will move to layover House File 26. Representative, Vice Chair Clardy, final comments. So sorry about that.
No problem. Thank you, Chair Yoakim. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Representative Bennett, for signing on to this bill, and thanks for all your great questions and the accountability thing. And so I'm glad we're solid here. But I want to say this bill, this plan, this program is based on having strong schools and strong community. And you kept hearing the conversation about relationship, you know, about that being the key to the success in this. So I want to thank you for having this program, and I want to thank you for supporting this program. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Clardy. With that, I'll move House File 2068 be laid over for possible inclusion in an education finance bill. And members, great work today. Tomorrow we have another full agenda. And don't forget, Friday we are meeting at 1 o'clock back in this room as well. With that, we are adjourned.